Welcome back to the Environmental Law Monitor. I'm your host, Taylor Stewart. I'm joined today by my co-host, Daniel Pope. I'm also joined by Scott Siegel of Bracewell's Policy Resolution Group. We're excited to have Scott on today. He has more than two decades of experience with policy and communications issues. He specializes in energy, environmental, and natural resources issues. While Scott heads up Bracewell's policy and strategic communications practice, he's also a practicing attorney who helps clients navigate legislative and regulatory issues, and we work together frequently. So Scott, I know you're very busy, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, so Daniel and I thought it would be great to talk to our listeners about the aftermath of the infamous One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which was passed last month. Our listeners will probably recall that many significant changes were made to some of the issues that we practice within by the bill. And some of these significant changes were in the energy and environmental space. Scott is the best person in the business to talk to about these developments. So I'm really glad that we have him here with us today. Scott, maybe before we talk about some of the more specific environmental law changes that were made by the bill, what was your high-level impression of the bill as ultimately signed by the president?
Right. Watching the development of OBBBA was a little bit like watching a very slow-motion steamroller moving ahead in a particularized direction. We knew what was going to happen. The only question was how significant it would be. And in the run-up to the passage of the bill, at least as far as the energy and environmental topics were concerned, there were a number of Republican members, for example, particularly, well, in both the House and in the Senate, that asked that even though there would be a paring back, for example, of clean energy tax incentives, that paring back, in the phrase that was used at the time, be more of a scalpel and less a sledgehammer, more a scalpel. And I think at the end of the day, while for some topic areas, there was a degree of discretion used in the way the underlying bill, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, was adopted, at the end of the day, the changes were so significant that it has had some impact on the markets and has been, I think, a little bit greater perhaps than most people anticipated. We've known for some time that the administration was more favorably disposed toward certain technologies than other technologies. For example, the administration has been supportive, that is, the Trump administration has been supportive of geothermal energy, hydroelectric, nuclear power, to a lesser extent, both hydrogen and carbon capture and sequestration, and of course, the broad range of dispatchable energy sources that are based on fossil fuels. So lots of energy sources, but certainly not the full range that was at play in the Inflation Reduction Act back during the Biden administration. But it's one thing to favor certain energy sources, another thing to both favor those energy sources and to take marked action against other energy sources. And I think at the end of the day, if you combine what happened legislatively in the One Big Beautiful Bill with what has happened administratively in subsequent statements made both by the president and by the Secretary of Interior, then you've seen that there's been some retrenchment, at least away from what we used to call an all of the above energy strategy, by literally favoring some dispatchable energy sources at the expense of other renewable energy sources. So I think that's the extent to which that happened, perhaps was not 100% foreseen, but the direction of it was foreseen.
That makes sense. And it seems like the bill and then the agency actions that have followed the bill have really been, as you sort of foreshadowed, focused on having a negative effect on wind and solar. Do you want to talk a bit about what you see as sort of the most significant impacts to the wind and solar industries from the bill?
Sure.
I know we have the tax credit cuts, which were pretty significant, and maybe some knock-on effects to other industries as a result of those.
Right. Obviously, we had some significant changes to the tax code. And I think it's been fair commentary for some time that a lot of renewable energy had a disproportionate reliance upon favorable tax treatment and good tax planning and good tax policy to change it. But the tax landscape did fundamentally change as OBBBA is implemented. It will continue to change. Those tech neutral power credits, that's for those of you who have a handy, much thumbed copy of your Internal Revenue Code, that sections 45Y and 48E now have compressed timelines and tougher guardrails associated with it. Many of the projects have to have begun construction sooner or to be in service by the end of 2027 if they're going to capture value out of those credits, as versus the IRA glide path, which was much more generous. The advanced manufacturing tax credit, which is 45X, generally phases down starting in 2031, but it does make some additions like metallurgical coal, not surprising, as eligible through 2029. Carbon capture and sequestration, and we at Rice have been involved in a number of projects like that. There is now parity between utilization of carbon and storage of carbon. So to that extent, 45Q is actually expanded if you're using carbon for purposes of, for example, enhanced oil recovery, which now receives the same credit value as dedicated storage does. So there's been some expansion there. But, you know, that may be a little bit of a tailwind for CCS EOR projects, but not tailwind necessarily across the board for everything else, particularly when you take into account changes that were made on the DOE funding side of things. And of course, there were significant changes there. Also, the area that the president already has the most significant authority in would be the development of energy projects on federal lands. And I think that OBBBA also plays to that hand that the president already has been dealt. Two sort of big shifts for solar and wind on federal lands, a new federal land fee regime with long-term right-of-way. While long-term right-of-way terms continue to persist, this sort of math around rent-free changes is gone now. And most notably, we have a capacity-based fees instead. Also, there is clearly elevated Department of Interior scrutiny for wind and solar. And we've seen that in the Department of Interior's order that Secretary Burgum signed, which requires a sort of secretarial level review for sort of 69 different regulatory undertakings, which can only be read. Even if you said, well, no, that makes sense. These are authorities that have been delegated to the secretary. It's still to centralize everything in one place does certainly create bottlenecks, which I think is an intended, is what is it they say, is a feature, not a bug. It is an intended consequence of doing it that way. So a lot of changes for solar and wind. And, you know, I have very good friends in that industry who say to me, we are viewing our vacation in the August, September timeframe as being measured in 90-hour increments, because about every 90 hours, something else happens that we have to inform members about, or we have to get people exercised about. Now, there has been some fighting back on this. There are Republican senators, for example, who are strongly supportive of wind and solar. In fact, there are three Department of Treasury confirmations that are being held up by Republican senators until there is more clarity and less of a confiscatory nature for what they're perceiving implementation of the tax provisions will look like, particularly for what are called foreign entities of concern or FEOC, and what are called and the safe harbors that are associated with the provisions on the tech neutral side. So there is some pushback, but I must say I'm not sure the pushback is fit to the task given how extensive the changes are that were made under OBBBA. By the way, a word on that name. I got to tell you guys this story. So as you know, the reason it's called the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, I mean, you know, the third B is bill. And so it weirdly is the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which is sort of strange. It's because the president sort of said, after having met with the Senate at one point, he said, I want one big beautiful bill. And this was when there was a choice between doing two reconciliation bills or one reconciliation bill. And he expressed a preference, and I think rightly so, because it's always harder to do two things than it is to do one thing. But it was the big beautiful part that I think stuck in everybody's head. And so that became the working title of the bill, and eventually became, actually, there is a provision of the bill that names the bill One Big Beautiful Bill. Now, of course, the Inflation Reduction Act passed under the Biden administration, which had the much more generous glide paths for renewable and cleaner energy tax credits, also has kind of a funky name. because, you know, you don't, it's not really a macroeconomic bill. It's whose sole intention was to reduce inflation. It actually increases government spending, which is not often associated with inflation reduction. But the point they were making is bringing more electrons to market and bringing more biofuels to market is a way to depress the price of energy. So in that sense, it reduces inflation, at least with respect to energy commodities. That was the argument, at least, that was proffered. But remember what the rules of budget reconciliation say. They say that provisions that survive the test of being included in budget reconciliation have to be budget related. So they have to increase, they have to decrease spending, increase spending, and they cannot be mere legislative provisions. Well, guess what? The title of a bill that names the act is a pure legislative provision. It doesn't raise or lower actual federal spending. It has no effect on the budget. So some Republicans, when Inflation Reduction Act was being considered, raised a point of order that struck the title Inflation Reduction Act from the law. So technically, we just call the Inflation Reduction Act the Inflation Reduction Act, but it's not really its title. And to my knowledge, I didn't see a similar amendment on OBBBA. So there we legitimately call it OBBBA. But the point is that there are lots of hinks that are related to this legislation because it passed as budget reconciliation legislation and not regular order legislation, up to and including how we entitled the bills. So that's your story about OBBA versus IRA. Fascinating.
And Scott, one of the things I'm always like paying attention to here in Austin, we've got a new Gigafactory. It's been churning out Teslas and specifically Cybertrucks, which are all over the roads in Austin. What did the OBBBA do on electric vehicles? You know, because it's similar to solar and wind that consumer credits have helped the industry get a foothold. Now there are more and more EVs on the road. What happened with the EV credits for ordinary purchasers?
Well, that is a good question. You know, first of all, let's talk about what the law was, you know, status quo ante, which was a $7,500 tax credit for an electric vehicle that was allocated based on the fleet that had been produced by the particular manufacturer. So, for example, take a Tesla, where Tesla was a very popular, well, at least in the point in time historically we're speaking, was a very popular brand that would often break through its production quota before which the $7,500 tax credit applied. So that meant that a certain number of Tesla purchasers received the $7,500 credit, but then beyond that, they did not receive the $7,500 credit because too many Teslas were being sold. By contrast, if you look at other electric vehicles that are, let's say, less popular, perhaps either because they're newer to the market or because they are less robust of an automotive platform, let's just say.
Not as stylish.
Less stylish, less...
More stylish, depending on your views on automobile design.
Right. or perhaps without the same performance characteristics, let's say, as a Tesla.
Right.
They didn't meet their... They didn't break through the total limitation on their fleet, and as a result, could continue to claim $7,500 credits. In a weird way, therefore, getting rid of the tax credit for a manufacturer who already has a popular car. And we are not likely to believe that the popularity of the Tesla was predicated on being able to, given the nature of the consumers for Tesla, was likely to be influenced lock, stock, and barrel by a $7,500 credit. Maybe not influenced, maybe it isn't zero influence, but not significant influence. So in a weird way, some said that getting rid of the tax credit had a disproportionate impact for Tesla competitors than it did for Tesla, because they were more dependent on the $7,500 credit. This is strange. This may go a certain way to explain why, at least on the early days, the erstwhile CEO of Tesla, who was a special government employee at the time, Mr. Elon Musk, was not terribly upset with the president for the treatment of electric vehicles. Now, as time went by, other market drivers, for example, the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard, the corporate average fuel economy tests, the way that had been established by the Biden administration, these are things that the President Trump began to repeal administratively, or in the case of the California waiver, through operation of the so-called Congressional Review Act. That, I like to think of it, for those toxicologists out there, is like a body burden that was developing for people who supported electric vehicles. And I think they became quite upset, including Elon Musk, that there were just too many actions being taken that were contrary to electric vehicles. And that sort of ended up where we were. But I don't think it's purely as a result of the change in tax credit, at least not for Tesla, but for perhaps for other vehicle manufacturers, yes. But it's the cumulative effect of the change in the tax credit plus these administrative changes in various, the DOT operated energy efficiency program, the EPA operated efficiency program, and the California vehicle standards that are predicated on California's use of its waiver under the Clean Air Act. When these were being changed, that really did have a much more profound effect on the projectability of the market for EVs. So I don't know if that answers your question, but there's a lot going on there.
That's all terrific, helpful context for tracking what's happening in the transportation world, at least with respect to EVs.
Yeah, there's really so much in the bill that it is hard to keep track of. It's helpful, Scott, to hear you distinguish between things that are budget items that are going to go in on reconciliation and then things that are non-budgetary. Mm-hmm. I think you and I have talked about this a little bit, about the sort of permitting reform efforts that were potentially making their way into the bill and then maybe at one point made their way out because in some ways they were technically not budgetary. So I think we saw some NEPA changes come and go, right? Can you talk us through what we were sort of tracking over several weeks before the bill was eventually signed?
Sure, sure. There were substantial regulatory reform provisions, some dealing with judicial review, some dealing with a total amount of time that could be considered for not just under NEPA, but under various statutes. There were quite significant regulatory review provisions. And remember, again, as I said, you have to, in order to survive the test, and we refer to this test as the Byrd rule, sometimes the application, so named not after the avian creature, but after a former Senator Byrd from West Virginia, Senator Robert Byrd, Bobby Byrd. This provision basically is what limited what could be included in a budget reconciliation bill. And those of us who have, for whom this wasn't our first time at the rodeo, sort of predicted that a lot of this stuff would fall out if it had no direct provision. It would have to have some form of linkage to either revenue raising or revenue or spending or the like. Now, there was a broad theory that was articulated at the time that the better our permitting system works, the more federal projects will be built, or the more projects that require federal approval will be built, and therefore the more federal taxpayers there will be, and that has a budget impact. That argument is too attenuated to meet the test. So anything that was attempted to be defended under that type of attenuated analysis actually fell out of the bill. So well, then what stayed in?
That almost sounds, Scott, like reasonable foreseeability and causation under NEPA, right? So very fitting.
Yes, this is not enough, right? Exactly. It's enough to screw up your NEPA permit or your NEPA consideration, your analysis, but it's not enough to keep you in under the Byrd rule. Good point. So now we do have this project sponsor opt-in fee, which can buy you essentially a schedule certainty. So you pay 125% of the estimated review cost, and the agency has to finish your environmental assessment in 180 days or an EIS, environmental impact statement, within 1 year. And so that provision, they said, well, because it's 125%, that is not merely incidental. Now, this idea of buying indulgences from the federal government generally is rejected under the Byrd rule because it's regarded as merely incidental to what you're trying to achieve. So if I said, this is what a client's actually said this to me from time to time. Well, what if we just had a provision that said we get favorable choice of venue for judicial review if we pay $100? Well, that would clearly be merely incidental, wouldn't it? Because you'd be achieving a whole lot of result for a whole little in expenditure. But the idea of having to pay 125% of what you anticipated you'd have to pay to get an EIS, and all you get in return is scheduling certainty, that finally, that narrow sliver of what was left of NEPA reform was considered to be not merely incidental. If something is merely incidental, the budgetary effect is merely incidental, it would violate the Byrd rule. It would not be accepted. So that is why that little slice of heaven was allowable under NEPA reform in the final bill, but pretty much not everything else. Now, here's an interesting little thing for, that's 101 level. Here's an interesting little 201 level for the Byrd rule and what it means for permitting reform. So we have this list of other things that were considered, but that the Senate parliamentarian, the very talented and quite objective Elizabeth McDonough, said no to. Some Republican senators believe that what they have been gifted by these denials under the Byrd rule is a roadmap of keywords and phrases that could be utilized to try and get more regulatory reform into subsequent reconciliation bills. You may say subsequent reconciliation bills. This first one was so hard to produce. What subsequent bills? Well, we know that the current Congress can do at least two more reconciliation bills, one that governs for fiscal year 26 and one that governs for fiscal year 27. So they could do two more. We don't think they have the patience or the time to do two more. So more likely, the thought would be that in the fall, they might try and do one more budget reconciliation bill. And the voluble chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, at least, and others, have suggested that they may try and follow what they're calling this sort of parliamentarian roadmap to try and save more permitting reform or regulatory reform language, but have it meet the test of the Byrd rule. Okay, so look out for that. That could be in October. I mean, you know, we're running out of fall.
That's right.
You know, but it could be as soon as October. But what happens in November? Well, we have a midterm election. That is, well, we get within, let me put it this way, we get within 1 year of a midterm election in November of 25. And generally speaking, the last year before a federal electoral event is not a good time to legislate. And so we'll be getting awful close to those midterm elections. And so we probably won't see a lot of major legislation as we get closer and closer and closer to the November of 26 midterm election. But we will potentially see more reg reform. Also, we may see more standalone permitting reform legislation, but I am not all that bullish on standalone permitting reform legislation that isn't pursuant to budget reconciliation. Why do I care about budget reconciliation? Well, it's because budget reconciliation only need pass the United States Senate by a simple majority. You cannot, it is a privileged motion, which means you cannot filibuster a budget reconciliation bill. By contrast, standalone permitting reform, if it's controversial, generally requires cloture. That's what we call a cloture in order to get through. It requires a supermajority in order to get through. And I don't think under current conditions with the amount of upset between the two parties that we're likely to get a supermajority on any permitting reform legislation. Others might disagree with me on that, but I think I'm right.
Both sides are looking at each other saying, you don't have the votes, right?
Right, exactly.
It is fascinating to see this sort of 125% figure, timeline guarantees for environmental assessments, environmental impact statements, which I think in the abstract, without any context of what's been happening in the courts and what's been happening at the Council on Environmental Quality, you may think, well, maybe some projects are not going to take that up. You want to have a defensible EA, you want to have a defensible EIS because you want to be able to go into the courts and say, well, hey, you know, the agencies did their job and now we can move forward on our project. But in the context of Marin, the decision of the Supreme Court, CEQ's withdrawal of the regulations, it's going to be interesting to see who takes up this opportunity here under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. who decides that the decisions from the courts and the CEQ give them enough certainty about how their permit will be reviewed in the courts, and who decides to go for both, right? And take advantage of all these new changes to NEPA to get their projects through.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the word that is often used about any form of permitting review is robustness. And you don't just want a decision. You want a decision that will stand up. And remember, the bill, OBBBA, doesn't change the underlying statute except for this question of scheduling.
That's right.
So if shortcuts are taken, it is possible that you could have purchased at the cost of 125% something that doesn't stand up in court. And that's something you obviously want to avoid. And while it's true that CEQ no longer essentially mandates the content or procedure for NEPA, it is true that with respect to this fee mechanics, so how this thing is supposed to work, that is kind of a CEQ, that's something the CEQ is working on. So determining how agencies would calculate that 125% of anticipated cost is going to be pivotal and is going to be controversial, especially how they handle large multi-agency reviews and potential disputes over cost estimates. So you can even see there that environmental opponents might say, well, I don't think that's 125%. We were not going to challenge on those grounds. So they could try and diminish the cost. Developers, as a general proposition, are going to want some degree of clarity on a payment, timing, escrow arrangements, refunds if timelines shift. What if you don't get it within the number of days? Do you get money back? You know, they're going to want to know that. And whether the clock pauses for supplemental analyses, which is one of the oldest issues that we've fought in the NEPA context. And frankly, the bill is quite silent on all of that. So as the bill usually is, a budget reconciliation bill has no legislative history, okay? You know, we had a very interesting case come up a little while ago about one of the tax provisions actually has a Scrivener's error in it. And for those of you who don't know what a Scrivener's error is, let me just say, that's where there is abundant legislative history of the direction Congress intended to go, but when they wrote it down in the actual legislation, they missed a comma or they missed a bracket or they had the wrong letter. And particularly in the language that regards Internal Revenue Code 25, Section 25, which deals with appliances, they seem to have made a Scrivener's error. But the problem is, you know, a Scrivener's error can be corrected, at least initially, by a court. That's not available here because there's no legislative history, because there are no conference reports, there are no committee reports. There is one colloquy that was done that was allowed by the Speaker of the House. So there's very little legislative history, and certainly none on Section 25. So there's you can't use the typical rules of Scrivener's errors. Plus, in the wide, wide world of sports, I can't find any uses of Scrivener's errors generally. And somebody out there perhaps listening will be able to correct me, and I'd love it if they would.
We're soliciting help with this.
Where a Scrivener's error analysis was used on the Internal Revenue Code. And the reason for that is that you pay your taxes based on what the code says. If it turns out the code was wrong later, they refund your taxes. And so we don't have the same case law that we have about Scrivener's errors in other parts of the U.S. code. What happened in this bill, OBBBA, is what happens in many budget reconciliation bills. Indeed, it's what happened in the Inflation Reduction Act, which is at the very end, they write it very fast. Congress is a little bit like high school students that are assigned a term paper. They don't do the term paper until it's due, right? And so it at the very end, they finally get around to doing all the work. And so there are inevitably mistakes are made. But there's no legislative history against which to measure those mistakes. And it makes it really difficult to correct them without something called technical corrections, which is an additional legislative process. If you don't do the technical corrections through the reconciliation process itself, a future reconciliation process, it means that Democrats and Republicans have to agree on what a technical correction to this bill would be. And even if Democrats believe there are mistakes made in the bill, what incentive do they have really to correct them? other, because they, not a single Democrat voted for the bill. So what incentive do they have?
Yeah, if I had to guess, they're probably going to just let this go haywire and see what happens. I feel like a Scrivener's error with no record is probably every lawyer's worst nightmare.
There's
not a lot of ways to get out of that.
No doubt. Although we did hear, though, I'm going to tell you, Taylor, we did hear that the Senate minority leader, Senator Schumer from New York, had a list of 25 of his own technical corrections that he'd like to see made in the bill.
But interesting. Maybe some trades on technical corrections to see who gets theirs in and who doesn't.
Let the record reflect I'm nodding my head. Yes. It'll take trades to get things done.
Well, we'll have to rely on our substantial Scrivener's error law audience to reach out to us and let us know some of the answers to Sagat's questions.
There's one other thing that I think is very interesting that emerged from OBBBA. For those of you who have worked with the federal government in partnership, perhaps through the Loan Guarantee Program at the Department of Energy, there was a bit of a repurposing of the Loan Guarantee Program that occurred in the context of the OBBA passage. And this is the so-called energy dominance financing. And what it basically did is that those of you who've worked on loan guarantees before may know that's Section 1706 authority. And this authority has now actually been named energy dominance financing, which expands eligible uses to increase capacity or output or to support grid reliability or to support the critical mineral supply chain. These are all new things in Title 17. It also appropriates $1 billion, you know, just to get the ball rolling through fiscal year 28. And it runs alongside rescissions, i.e. pulling back of federal expenditures, various IRA DOE pots of money. So developers should watch out for guidance from the Loan Program Office at the Department of Energy for what the new eligibility tests will be and what the new credit subsidy prices will be. Why do you care? Because in the olden days, you couldn't finance essentially a fossil fuel project through Title 17 loan guarantees. They were meant for clean energy financing. But now it's been changed. Now they're meant for projects that will enhance the energy dominance of the United States, which is not much of a defined term. There is more definition to it than that in 1706, but it'll require a guidebook out of the Loan Program Office to know exactly how to apply for these things. So why do I bring it up? Because there are lots of projects that people might have written off and said could not be available for DOE funds that may be available for DOE funds now. By contrast, there are other projects that once were available that technically may still be available, but are not likely to get loan guarantees anymore. So yeah, so it's a big deal. It's a repurposing of the program.
I know that you and your team have been working with clients who have had funds from the Loan Programs Office being embargoed or withheld, or they're under review. And we've been doing a lot of work on those issues. So if there are listeners that are having issues with those DOE offices, you should definitely reach out to Scott and team. They are leading the charge on some of those issues, and they are extremely complicated. And it does seem like there is this sort of switch that the office has historically been responsible for giving funding and grants to clean energy projects. And now they've sort of opened the door to all sorts of different technologies that contribute to quote unquote energy dominance. And what does that look like for recipients or potential recipients on the clean energy side? What does it look like for new projects that historically haven't qualified for that type of funding, but now they do? I think that in the next year is going to be a real watershed development that I know the PRG team will be watching closely.
We sure will be. And, you know, I also want to tell folks that are listening in, don't lose heart. You may hear the president of the United States either verbally or through Truth Social or through other mechanisms by which he communicates, say things about particular energy sources and feel like there's just no chance if that's what you're advancing. But I would remind everybody that the trajectory toward diversity in energy sources, particularly in electric generation, is a result of a number of different policies, only one of which is the availability of federal largesse either through tax policy or through direct funding or loan guarantees. I mean, it also is a result of what customers are asking for, It's a result of state programs. It's a result of compliance strategies for regulatory programs. We obviously have electric utilities and other power providers that have assured their public utility commissions that they will have a particular retirement schedule in mind. And so these are all things that continue to advance some diversity. Now, is the rate of that diversity slowed by creating either material uncertainty or direct change in federal funding or in tax incentives? Yes, I think you'd have to be whistling past the graveyard to not think that there is some change that's in the offing. But does it mean that the genie of lower carbon energy sources has been put permanently back in the bottle? I think the answer to that is no. I think our industrial customers, for example, want to be able to choke carbon out of their process in order to make their products and services more internationally competitive. And so there are lots of reasons to see a continued advancement as far as lower carbon energy sources are concerned. So I would just say, don't take heart, dear listeners. It's not all about tax credits.
Well, and Scott, I think that's a great point too. I just got back from the Texas Environmental Law Super Conference, and for being a conference focused on air emissions and the management of solid and universal waste, among other things, it was hard to go to any particular panel and not hear data centers mentioned and to not see graphs of how our energy needs are projected to really skyrocket in a way that, you know, we've had generation growth kind of keep pace with demand. And we're looking at sort of a hockey stick graph of need here and what may look like the final blow for renewable sources of generation. That just may be a moment, one dark night after we all pivot back to being just complete energy omnivores and we'll take it wherever we can get it.
Right. That's an excellent point. I mean, when I worked for electric power generators, whether they be a public power, whether they be investor-owned utilities or even some independent power producers, it just depends on you know, who's on the other end when the phone rings. But I will tell you that for most of my career, we have not dealt with a situation of a positive growth curve in electricity demand that was anything more than either anecdotal or slight. And now we have a completely different situation. And that relates to these hyperscale data centers, particularly those that cater to artificial intelligence. It also relates, though, candidly, to onshoring and the president himself's direct desire to onshore more manufacturing in the United States, which is electricity intensive, depending on what's being made. And to an extent that we probably would have predicted is lesser than we thought before, the electrification of, you know, households and businesses. It's not that it's not occurring, but I think there's a greater comfort level with natural gas use, both in electric power generation and for other thermal energy needs. So, but nonetheless, you know, to quote Monty Python, if we lose even one electron, God gets quite irate. I mean, you know, we cannot. That's a deep cut for Monty Python. So you have to figure that one out. But I'll tell you, you know, the thing about solar and wind, for example, is you can build it out pretty quick. Now, obviously, we've had some complications in supply chains that have resulted from other legislative or administrative changes advanced by the administration. But by and large, you can still build out renewables pretty quickly. And sometimes what folks who are developing data centers will tell you is, yes, they want that power to be dispatchable. They want it to be reliable, of course, but they also need it to be fast to market. So I think what that tells us is that we have a combination of lower carbon energy sources, dispatchable conventional energy sources, and energy storage, right? And mixing it all together creates the mix that serves that huge increase in energy demand that we've seen. I mean, what is it? I think the most widely quoted data point on all this, Daniel, is Goldman Sachs report that says 160% increase in energy demand by 2050 or whatever it is.
Yeah, our load needs in ERCOT here in Texas are are projected to go from about 85 gigawatts to 130, 150 gigawatts in 10 or 15 years, which is just crazy to think about for our humble little, you know, Republic of Texas of power.
Yeah, huge, huge jump.
And so many things too. For us, it's not just hypercenters. I mean, the irony is the more we seek to produce oil and gas out of the Permian, the higher our electricity demand becomes, right? So even if we were to say we're 100% committed to oil and gas, which I don't think the people or even the government officials of Texas want that as a policy, but even if they were to say that, there would be a big strain on electricity demand that would be necessary to have sufficient oil and gas production.
Yeah, it seems like we just can't get this done with only a few of the ingredients. It seems like we need all of them. It'll be really interesting to see how this actually plays out, especially over the next few years. As Daniel and you've both pointed out, the insurgence of data centers and the jump in the need for electricity, will there be instances of blackouts or lapses in service due to lack of power or the challenge surrounding being able to dispatch it quickly? I hope that's not the case. I fear that that may end up being the case, especially if we're picky about what types of power sources that we actually deploy, but it really only time will tell. But Scott, I could literally sit here and talk to you all day about these things. As usual, I have learned so much in a mere 45 minutes, more than I would ever learn in any other conversation. We appreciate you coming on so much. And if our listeners have any questions for Scott, please feel free to reach out to us or Scott. You'll find our information on our website and in the description of this podcast episode. And we will certainly have you on again, Scott, to talk about literally anything that we can think of to ask you about, because you're just a wealth of knowledge. So thank you. We appreciate it.
I think Scott already invited himself back for a fall reconciliation breakdown. So we'll see if that happens. There's much to watch in this space. I mean, it's for environmental lawyers like Taylor, me, and maybe I should just speak for myself, but it's so easy to go from matter to matter, project to project, and be involved really with the granular 40 CFR citations. And it's so helpful to have you on, Scott, to talk about these changes in incentives, grants, tax credits, funding mechanisms that really shape the types of projects that we're working on year over year. And I can't think of anyone I appreciate hearing from more that helps give me a sense of, okay, well, what's the landscape really looking like after all of this? The landscape that I'm going to be running around and doing my legal work in, right? And so thank you so much for being here with us to sort of be our Virgil as we walk through this inferno, hopefully on our way to paradise, but we'll see what happens.
Daniel and Taylor, let me just say this to both of you, which is that sometimes we're at one end of the elephant, right? And you're at the other end of the elephant. I won't speculate which is which
end.
But developing public policy, and this is what I say to clients, developing public policy is the great place to start. And if you want to win the game of encouraging, for example, investment in a particular technology or the development of a particular project, you need to begin with the policymakers and you need to end with the regulators, at least from a government affairs perspective. And one of the reasons I enjoy the job that I have is because I get to work with people like you two, who are the best at what they do on the regulatory side of things. Together, that's the complete spectrum that's needed for an effective government affairs strategy for a project or for a technology. So it's a pleasure to work with you both, and I'm happy to come back anytime.